Good morning, good morning, good morning. Al Bergeson, your host for Smart Talk this week. You know, when I get up in the morning, get ready to make breakfast, what do? Coffee, start some eggs, do something, get the morning paper, go out front, bring it in, open it up, and you'd think maybe I would look at the main section. No, I got to be honest with you, I look at sports section first. But right after that, I go to the op-ed page. Even I glance at the headlines, of course, but I go to the op-ed page, and I love to read what people think is going on, their opinion, what's new. It sort of gives me a sense of where the zeitgeist, at least for the opinion writers and the newspaper, are at. We're going to talk about op-eds today. We're going to talk about how you get into it, what you do, what chances you have of having one accepted. And if you have any questions about writing an op-ed, I want you to call in. 790-2040 is our call-in number. And the reason we're doing op-eds today is because of our guests. And it's Professor Michael Schaller of the U of A's History Department. Michael is a distinguished historian who's written books about Reagan and Nixon and China, and he's just covered loads of topics. He's also one of the, if not the most interesting op-ed writer here in the local newspaper. And what's distinctive about Michael's op-eds is that he brings an historian's perspective to the topic at hand. And he often links that historical comparison to what's going on today. And if it's just history, it's so fascinating that you enjoy it just for the reading. Michael, welcome.
Thank you, Al.
It's good to have you aboard. So, folks, let's get started by asking Michael, which I'm going to do, if he would tell us about one of his op-eds that he's written. And one of them, I know he's talked a little about, has to do with the origin of the Statue of Liberty. Now, it may seem obvious to you, and it may not, but it's a much more fascinating story than you ever expected. Michael.
Thanks, Al. Well, you know, one of the things I'd like to say, and thank you for that kind introduction, is that in writing an op-ed, one of the goals is to bring an opinion on a topic, but also give it some perspective. And I wanted to avoid the kind of contentious point-counterpoint we see in so much contemporary news coverage. And I thought bringing an historical perspective to an issue in the news today would be of interest both to me and hopefully to readers. And, you know, for most of my career, I've written for other academics, other scholars. But this gave me a chance, I hope, to reach a broader audience and give them some, as I say, some perspective on a question. In the last year, with all the controversy over immigration, legal and illegal, interestingly, the Statue of Liberty came up as a debating point. And at one point, a Trump administration official, Stephen Miller, who's his advisor on immigration, denounced pro-immigrant forces for misleading the public about the history of the Statue of Liberty, pointing out, correctly in a way, that when it was built or erected in the mid-1880s, it was not associated with immigration, and that the famous poem that's put on its base was 20 years later, the Emma Lazarus poem, Mother of the New Colossus, in which she called the statue Mother of Exiles. But of course, what it missed the point, while factually correct, pro-immigration people were correct also in saying eventually the statue meant everything to immigration, as 20 million immigrants coming between the 1870s and 1920s passed that statue, the first thing they saw about America.
So right off the top, is again for all of us aspiring op-ed writers, and I'm learning as much as you folks are just listening to Michael, because I don't write op-eds, is you set up a situation in which it's obvious that it's about immigration, but that its origin had nothing to do with immigration, raising the obvious question. I'm just giving you like a De Gaulle news conference with a setup question. What then was the Statue of Liberty about? Why did France give it to us?
Well, that's a great story in and of itself. The original design for the Statue of Liberty had, again, nothing to do even with the United States, no less immigration.
Oh, my God.
It had to do with the Suez Canal. The designer, of the prototype for it wanted to build a giant lighthouse at the northern end near Alexandria of the recently opened French-built Suez Canal. And it would be a giant lighthouse of a woman, perhaps an Egyptian belly dancer, holding a lamp, and it would guide ships through the Panama Canal. The canal company was not interested in the multi-million dollar cost of this, and the design was put away until several years later in the mid-1870s, when a group of French promoters, also canal builders, led by Ferdinand de Lesseps, who had played a role in the Suez Canal, hoped to build a Panama Canal. But they needed, in effect, U.S. permission. The United States, because of its proclaimed Monroe Doctrine, had a sort of veto over European involvement in Central and South America. So to win U.S. goodwill and permission, the French Panama Canal promoters came up with the idea of making a high-profile gift to the American people. And it was, the old design was repurposed as a goddess of liberty. And again, it was designed to show a bond between France and the U.S., having nothing directly to do with immigration.
So let me get this right. The model for the Statue of Liberty was initially envisioned as an Egyptian belly dancer. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, strange as it may seem. Though, again, it was redesigned as a goddess, a Roman goddess of liberty.
Gotcha.
But again, not related to immigration. In fact, it was related more to the anti-slavery movement in the decade after the Civil War. The original statue had a prominent feature of the goddess Liberty was standing on chains that were chained to African slaves and breaking the chain. The chain is still there in much reduced form in the final version of the statue. The problem was de Lesseps and his promoters couldn't get money, enough money to make the casting. And so they made part of the statue the arm and sent it to the United States in the mid-1870s.
The arm and the torch.
Yeah. And it was, but not a, not connected to the rest of the statue. It was sent to the U.S. and put on display in a park in Midtown Manhattan for several years, but generated very little interest. There were all sorts of attempts to have children fund it, to do things. Ultimately, Joseph Pulitzer, the newspaper publisher, created a GoFundMe. GoFundMe campaign in which subscribers would send in small donations, and eventually it was enough to pay for the casting of the larger statue in the mid-1880s. Another proposal to fund it, because the statue was being given to the U.S., but the United States would have to provide the land, an island off Manhattan, as well as the pedestal, the large stone pedestal. So the costs of that had to be borne by somebody. U.S. Congress and the New York legislature refused to appropriate a penny.
Isn't that fascinating when you think about it, that such a iconic aspect of America now was something in its early days that no one even wanted to
In fact, there was a proposal, which sounds very au courant, to sell advertising space on the statue as a way of financing its construction.
Oh, my God, just like inside an athletic stadium or something like that, or European soccer players, which have the name of the company right on their jersey.
Exactly. But in the end, the GoFundMe campaign provided enough money. When the statue was finally erected, and Gustav Eiffel of the Eiffel Tower fame saved it, because after it was cast, it was a very thin copper coating. And the question was, how would it support itself? It needed a lattice inside. And Gustav Eiffel, who was doing all this pioneering design work for the Eiffel Tower, came up with a very intricate lattice of steel props that were put inside the statue to keep it from collapsing. Interestingly, when it was finally opened in the mid-1880s in New York Harbor, the statue was put under the control of the U.S. Lighthouse Commission. Harking back to its early design.
Yeah.
And it later, not associated with immigration, if you look at the contemporary news stories, symbol of Franco-American partnership, the United States did give permission for the French to try to build their Panama Canal. It was an utter disaster, and after 1900, the United States itself took it over.
Did it come over in pieces and get assembled here, or did the whole thing on some large ship just get brought?
No, it was brought in pieces and assembled.
And assembled here, and
yes.
then put up. Wow.
And of course, its association with immigration came after 1900. Emma Lazarus's poem, she had died in the 1880s, but her poem about give me your humble, your poor, etc., that we associate with the statue, was put on in about 1903 as a memorial to her. And then as millions of Eastern and Southern European immigrants came in waves in the early 20th century, the statue was the first thing they saw approaching America. And for generations of families, it became the symbol of immigration, freedom, and migration to the United States.
You could almost imagine if the World Trade Center had been built earlier and people came in, that they would look at that and you would almost say, you know, because it's just a symbol. I mean, the Statue right. of Liberty isn't a real lady with a torch, but it's more
right.
human. But you could also imagine almost anything, a tree, you know, that you would see. But there was the statue.
Right. And it was a remember, this was a pre-skyscraper age. The Manhattan
yes.
skyline was low rises.
So it really stuck out. It really stuck out. Wow. So you had the idea, and about how long, in terms of lines and pages, was the op-ed that you wrote from this idea?
Well, that's the other challenge in writing op-eds. As you can tell, professors tend to be verbose, both verbally and in their writing. When you do an op-ed, you're constrained anywhere between 500 or 600 words and maybe a max of 1,000 words. And so trying to squeeze in attitudes and facts and incidents and anecdotes into that is a challenge.
Well, you know, it's the same thing that we have when we're on air, that you get faculty members in and they get going and they don't understand that the medium dictates, just like the op-ed
sure.
dictates how long you can do it. Or when I interrupt someone, it's nothing personal. It's just that we need a dialogue sense of bumpy, 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 bump back and forth to make the whole thing go. So about how many pages roughly are most op-eds?
Well, if you say 3 to 4 pages, you know, double spaced
yeah. typed,
yeah,
are about that. Okay, fantastic. Did you send it off to the New York Times? Did you send it off to the Washington Post? Did you send it off here locally? Where did you send it off? And before you get started, we got to take a break. So, folks, stick with us. How you can do op-eds and more interesting ones from Michael Schaller. Smart Talk, Al Bergeson, your host, and the guest today is Michael Schaller, op-ed writer. He's a historian, too, but we're talking about his op-ed work, so we're going to call him now an op-ed writer for the local paper, and he's also had op-eds published, am I right, Michael? New York Times?
Yes.
Fantastic. And that one was about Godzilla.
It was. Godzilla and nuclear testing.
Which was a similar set of aha. So before we went to break, I said I'd ask Michael to tell us, when you get this idea, when you write it up, 3 pages, double space type, where do you send it off to? Where's a good place to start? Should you try for the New York Times at the top or the Wall Street Journal? Or should you go local? What should you do?
And
feedback's always important.
Yes. So what I do is I typically do a first draft of an idea, send it to 3 or 4 people, they send it back with often caustic suggestions, but invariably they're correct, because things that any writer thinks are so obvious are not obvious to other people. So that's the first thing I do, and it gets shorter, it gets longer, it changes. One of the key things about an op-ed is this so-called so what moment. As an historian, I can chronicle facts, but the question is, so what did they mean ultimately? What did they mean originally, and what do they mean today? And so that's one of the challenges, the artistic challenges or the creative challenges. But then it's the practical. I decided that it would be useful to do these for the local paper, the Arizona Daily Star. I contacted the editor, Sarah Gasson, who edits the editorial page, and said, we chatted. I said, would you be interested in some historically informed articles about contemporary issues that aren't argumentative, you know, but rather bring a perspective to an issue? And she said yes, and I've begun submitting these, and I've done, I don't know, 8 or 10, and they're invariably too long or lack that hook, as you would, that, you know, to get a reader and say, ah, that's what's interesting about this. So it's a multi-stage process that involves a lot of rewriting. I think I've spent more time rewriting drafts of these op-eds than I probably did on the serious, at least in terms of style, the serious scholarship that I did over a 40-year period.
Yeah, it's fascinating. What people often don't understand, even when they're doing it, is that each medium has its own criteria. So screenplays, you know, 120 pages, two turnarounds, there's a whole bunch of things that make it sound mechanical as hell, but it works for movies. Writing a book, writing a research article, and writing an op-ed piece that, after all, is an opinion editorial, and it requires that to be done. Chances of getting something in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal are?
Those are challenging. You know, they must get thousands of submissions.
They must get thousands. And you can also just send them in blankly. You don't need to call the editor like you
That's
did
right.
with the local paper here.
Right.
And you can just do it. All right, let's go off to and talk about another one of your things. And we're going to swing from the Statue of Liberty to another icon in America, and that's the movie Gone with the Wind. What was your initial aha about that movie that led you to think, damn, that could be an interesting op-ed piece?
Well, a couple of years ago, I was writing about, for another book, about World War II, and I came upon memoirs of a German set of memoirs in which the memoirist described on the night of June 20th or 21st, 1941, going to a private screening at Nazi Party headquarters of the American movie Gone with the Wind.
Nazis and Gone with the Wind. Wow, what a title.
And Joseph Goebbels, the rabid propaganda minister of the Nazi regime, showed this movie. It had debuted about a year and a half earlier in the U.S., but even though U.S. and Germany weren't at war yet, very few American movie products were being shown in Germany. But Goebbels arranged for, I guess, a pirated copy to be shown, and the audience loved it. Their reaction was somewhat different than many other people's. They saw it as a political movie about the positive aspects of slavery and racism in the Old South, and how that was showing a model America that had gone off course after the Civil War by becoming more equal, and that this movie highlighted what they saw as the epitome of the American experience, slavery and racism enshrined in law.
And white supremacy.
White supremacy,
as we would call it today. Now, it is the case that they weren't the only non-Americans who saw, well, lots of other countries
yes.
saw it, of course, but another one caught your eye, and that was?
That was the Japanese partners in the Axis Alliance with Nazi Germany. The Japanese also had limited access, especially after the Pearl Harbor attack. But when the Japanese army conquered the British colony of Singapore early in 1942, they seized copies of Gone with the Wind and Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the first full-color animated movie, brought them back to Tokyo, and showed them to a select audience of Japanese military leaders. And again, in a memoir, one of the participants said, after watching the movie, which was a four-hour, longest movie, probably commercial movie ever made to that point, the Japanese audience was despondent. These strutting generals sat around mumbling, and what the tone of the audience was, oh my God, how are we going to beat people who made such an incredible movie, technologically advanced film? And it became a sort of metaphor for despair that despite early victories, Japan might have bitten off far more than it could chew.
What's interesting here, well, a lot of things are interesting, of course, but what's interesting here is it wasn't that we bit off more than we could chew attacking Pearl Harbor and bringing Americans into the war because of the vast industrial plant, Detroit, manufacturing, ships, et cetera, but it was how aesthetically good they were. I mean, the shock was one of aesthetics, or is it the technical way of putting together the film?
Oh, the technical. The Japanese had a film industry that went back, but they were black and white. This was the first big major color movie. I don't know that it was the first, but it was the first blockbuster full color movie, just as the Disney animation was the first full color animated movie, and scenes like the burning of Atlanta and the scope and scale of Gone with the Wind just blew away the Japanese audience. They had never seen a film of that dimension, and they figured, I mean, correctly as it turned out, thank goodness, that the technology behind that film was a technology of a far more powerful country than they realized.
Wow. That's incredible. And you think about the technology even today, you think about what was then the advantage of Japanese cars over Americans, the fit and finish or the fine Japanese pens, but that sense of technology. Ironically, the Germans and their fine tooled machinery were also very engineeringly advanced, and you think would have affected them too. It might have, but the Nazis clearly had an ideology,
right?
And that's what they picked out.
And in the Japanese case, well, they had their own racial hierarchies in among Asians and so forth. A black-white division was not significant to them, so they didn't see the slavery white supremacy issue as significant in the movie the way the Nazis did. They saw the technique of the movie making as the important point.
790-2040, that's our call in number. We're here with Professor Michael Schaller from the UA History Department, who's also a very good and prolific op-ed writer. Please check your back page of the main section of the Morning Daily Star, and if you see a Michael Schaller op-ed, please read it, in good part because the history and the ironies in history that Michael has just an intuitive sense for noticing are really a joy to read. It's not that there isn't opinion there, but rather than just opinion, it is actually probably more historical, interesting things to think about and talk about. All right, Statue of Liberty, done. Gone with the Wind, done. You've got so many, it's fantastic. Let's shift, since we're sort of on World War II topic and we're on Nazis for some reason, let's shift to another one of your great op-ed pieces, which has to do with book burning in World War II. Now, there's two sides again. It's one of the architectural features of Michael's op-eds, that he picks two things, two countries or one country, and finds something interesting and ironic. What is it with book burning in World War II?
I was particularly interested in how Americans reacted to the phenomena of book burning in World War II. Early in the Nazi regime, there were these public sort of throwing books on pyres, and one of the many horrors of it wasn't done just by Nazi thugs. It was done by university students and professors at German universities who got into this campaign of purging non-Aryan books from the library. And Americans were horrified by it, how a civilized country could degenerate so quickly. And one of the things that interested me was the reaction in the American popular press to it, and it was universally abhorred. In fact, it was some of the first public use of the word Holocaust was used not in relation to the eventual killing of people, but the destruction of books and art in from German libraries. And it reminded many people of the German poet Heinrich Heine in the 19th century, who once wrote, "Where they burn books, they'll eventually burn people," which was a
wow.
prophetic prediction.
It's also an interesting comment that we often get more offended. I remember, was it not the Taliban, but ISIS, but some Islamic fundamentalist groups would be destroying statues and whatnot.
That's
and
right.
There was a huge outrage there. There was also a huge outrage of people being killed. Don't get me wrong, but it's interesting how the cultural thing sometimes can set things off before you do it. We just got the signal from our tech director John that it's time to take a break. Stay with us. We'll be back with Michael Schaller talking about book burning and the American alternative during World War II. We're back. We're back once again. Smart Talk. Al Berger's your host with Michael Schaller, U of A historian, and for today, talking about his op-eds, how you do them, and the different ones that he's written. Let me just get in a quick announcement. The College of Social and Behavioral Sciences, SBS, at the University of Arizona, has its second round of community classrooms coming up this spring. Noam Chomsky, the famed linguist and political commentator, is giving one, and loads of other people. So if you're interested in signing up for one of these community classrooms, please just go on Google and just type in U of A community classrooms, and you will find all the information about the courses, the reading lists, and how much it costs, and when they're offered, et cetera, et cetera. We have a caller. Michael, before we get back to you on Nazi book burning, let's take a caller. Charles, you're on the air. What's up?
Thanks, Al and Michael. This is a fascinating discussion. Something I'd like to bring up, and it may be a little bit out of chronological order that you're going in, but we have a modern sort of a way of thinking. I wouldn't even call it a pedagogy, but just a way of thinking where we compare our modern standards to the previous standards of the country from the time of our formation. And then, of course, no one measures up to the standard that you have now, that they're tried and found wanting in terms of statuary and in terms of the fact that the invalidation of the founding of our country, because many of the people who founded it had slaves and such, one of whom fathered several children with slaves. And it's I call it a disease. I'm very judgmental. I call that a disease. Can you comment on how we got from being sort of somewhat neutral observers of history to turning on our own and judging history by applying today's standards to yesterday's standards? And can you see any pathway forwards to sort of undo that mess?
I'm going to turn this over to Michael.
Yeah, sure. That's an interesting point. And I know it's much discussed. You can see it in terms of what to do with Confederate statues, for example, in some southern cities.
Sigmund Freud was a sexist, et cetera.
Right, right. And I think it's important to acknowledge both halves of that equation. You have to understand people in the context of their times, and historians try to do that. You also have to understand why values and attitudes shift. And so, yes, I mean, do you want to throw out the Declaration of Independence because Jefferson was a slave owner and, you know, had affairs or, you know, had a slave woman that he had children with? No, I think they each stands on their own, but each is valid. And I think it's important to look at both in the context. And, you know, one way that people have proposed dealing with this is through contextualizing things. So, for example, take a southern statue of General Beauregard, somebody, you know, in the town square in somewhere in Alabama. Is taking it down the right thing to do, or is contextualizing it, putting in another statue or putting in an explanation of who he was and why and how our views change? And I think that's the way most historians would prefer to deal with things, not to just throw out the baby with the bathwater, but to put in context that explains who and what and why and how we've changed.
You know, one of the contexts I think it's important and what I'd like you to talk about for a lot of this statuary is it wasn't erected immediately after the Civil War as a kind of memory or memorial to clearly loads of Southern soldiers who had died, but it came in Reconstruction or even the early 20th century. Could you talk a little about that, Michael?
Yeah, in the case of the Confederate statues and memorials, it does have a political context that I think it's important to say. As Al mentioned, many of these were not just immediate post-Civil War memorials to the dead, but they were sort of statements at the end of Reconstruction of a reassertion of Southern power. There was a second burst of Confederate statuary, which was in the Civil Rights era in the 1950s and 60s, were put up. In fact, some of the Confederate flag emblems that were integrated into Southern state flags, et cetera, didn't date from the 19th century, but in many cases, several cases at least, dated to the Civil Rights era. So I think pointing out why and how and when is important, and it without denigrating the valor or the history of local people or Jefferson's brilliant contributions to the notion of liberty, while also saying he lived in an era where humans were owned as slaves. But pointing that out, I think there's a way to balance it without having historical amnesia.
There's also, I think, a sociological problem that underlies a lot of this. As an immigrant society, the United States, since the beginning, has waves upon waves of immigrants with different religions, different backgrounds, some coming on their own, others, such as African slaves, not of their own will. And as folks and groups get absorbed into the society, their values, beliefs, what was done before, needs also to become, as full citizens, part of the pantheon or picture of what America is. And that sometimes involves changing other acknowledgments. So do we really need Columbus Day, you know, or should we add something about a Native American Day? And so that is a constant thing. So I guess what I'm thinking is, we've seen it in the past, it will probably continue as part of the, you know, in a way, healthy turbulence of America absorbing, honoring, and moving forward with its different groups that makes it up.
Let me just say, Al, because something of interest to you and perhaps the caller, I must admit that I didn't know much about the origins of Columbus Day. And recently there have been, you know, counter demonstrations to Columbus Day.
I see an op-ed piece growing.
Well, it wouldn't be original to me. Indigenous Peoples Day, seeing Columbus's exploration as the beginnings of a disaster for Native American peoples. But that issue aside, it wasn't until the late 19th century that Columbus was widely honored in the United States. He had largely been a forgotten or ignored figure. People knew about his expeditions, but he wasn't revered. He wasn't revered, and instead, in the 1880s, there had been a series of attacks on Italian immigrants in New Orleans. There was actually a lynching of a whole group of Italians. The Italian government was protesting, and as part of the effort to appease this foreign problem, I think it was the Garfield administration or the Harrison administration decided to create a national holiday honoring Columbus as a way of smoothing over Italian-American relations. And it became a sort of habit, and then Italian-American fraternal groups began promoting it. And by the 20th century, it became a standard holiday. But its origins, again, were in a very for a very different reason than people think.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. You know, there's that old saying that funerals are for the living and not for the dead. You might also say that holidays, acknowledgments are in part for the living and contemporary issues as much as they are for pastors.
Sure.
You know, we've drifted a little, which has been good. Charles had a great call and a great comment. We appreciate it. From where we left off, which was talking about Nazi book burning, what's the contrast in the shallow way of there's this and there's that? What's the that?
Well, there is a wonderful contrast to Nazi book burning, and that was American book publishing during World War II. The U.S. government, with the active encouragement of Franklin Roosevelt, decided that 16 million Americans in service, volunteering and drafting after the Pearl Harbor attack, needed something to do. And, military life was a combination of terror and boredom. And officers routinely said they need books to read. And so there was a program of voluntary send books to your boys in uniform, but that didn't really work very well. People would unload cookbooks and technical manuals on how to fix your washing machine. So the government, with the Pentagon, the federal government, and book publishers, created a wartime books program in which publishers would publish inexpensive, in fact, they were free to soldiers, but they cost about 10 cents each to produce, little paperbacks designed to fit in a soldier's vest or front pocket of his uniform or hip pocket of his pants. And tens of millions of books were published under this program during World War II. And they were everything from Western adventures to poetry to novels. It created overnight a paperback book industry that had barely existed before World War II. But it also gave us some American classics. The Great Gatsby had been published in the 1920s and forgotten. It was reissued in the mid-40s as a soldier's paperback and has become a perennial bestseller ever since. Oddly enough, the most popular book, especially among combat soldiers during World War II, was a book that's a real weeper, Tree Grows in Brooklyn, published in 1944.
And why do you think that was so popular?
It was about an immigrant girl who is plucky and hardworking, and despite poverty and hardship, makes it in the world, and it's a reflection on her nurturing family and their challenges. And it was about home. It was about family and love and community. And incredibly enough, Marines on Pacific Islands would get this book and write letters to the author, Betty Smith, about how in the midst of fighting on Iwo Jima, they found solace in this book. And as I say, 70 or 80 million of these books were published during wartime. And soldiers, when they left Europe or the Pacific, would donate these books to local libraries. And in fact, in the early post-war years, many European libraries, where the Nazis had destroyed many books, were restocked with these American paperbacks.
Pocketbooks, the publisher or the brand for that thing, may actually have come from books being designed to fit into GIs' pockets?
Yes, there had been inexpensive paperbacks before the war, but they tended to be a niche market. A lot of them were sort of soft core romances and that sort of thing, but respectable authors and companies didn't put out paperbacks.
Hardcover suddenly was, it was okay now to have hardcover.
That's right, it was legitimate.
Soft cover.
It was legitimate.
You would only do that kind of thing.
And this is the generation, remember, the last book published in the series was How to Take Advantage of Your GI Bill Benefits, Go to College or Go to Technical Training School. And so it was a sort of arc of, you know, entering the service and reading a novel and leaving and finding out about your GI Bill benefits.
Today, would the Army, Navy send out video games for something to do between combat or make sure everyone has a smartphone or an iPhone?
Because
you wouldn't send a paperback book.
That's right.
Well, you might, but I think it's more social media or visuals.
Right, with social media, although I have to tell you that can create its own problems. My son was in the Marines, and when he was stationed in Afghanistan and Iraq, soldiers would, and fellow Marines would get emails, somebody wanting to friend them. But the friend might be an ISIS or Taliban member wanting to know their location. And so they had to send out an order that you couldn't befriend any stranger on your smartphone.
Oh, my God. I'm surprised that hasn't come up in the congressional hearings for Mark Zuckerberg to deal with.
Right.
That people want to friend him. That's a fantastic story. So let me just do a little quick commentary. It strikes me that, again, folks, when you think about an op-ed and making it have a little zing, the story about Nazi book burning has been done before, and I suppose the story about paperbacks in the Army has done before. But since both of them are in the same rough time period, World War II, and because you have people opposed and with whole different value systems, it becomes a fantastic metaphor. Fear of alternative ideas and whatnot, Nazis, opening up, wanting your people to read with immigrants, the United States. We got to take a break. Stick with us, 790-2040, and we'll be back and talk about another of Mike's exciting op-eds. Smart Talk, Al Bergeson, your host here with op-ed writer, Tucson historian at the U of A, Michael Schaller. We've been talking about World War II kinds of op-eds he's written, one about a book burning in Nazi Germany and about Americans giving out paperbacks to GIs. In the same time period, Michael has had another op-ed, and that had to do with Superman. Tell us.
Well, I grew up in the 50s and 60s reading Superman comics, as most of my peers did in those days, and you know, he chased bank robbers and other villains. But Superman actually has an interesting origin story. The two kids from Pittsburgh high school graduates who conceived of him in the early 30s saw him as a responder to the alleged crime wave of the early Depression years. But by the late 1930s, when they actually published the first Superman comic, many of the original comics from the late 30s and early 40s, Superman was actually a social justice warrior. He was fighting entrenched interests, big business, coal mine operators exploiting labor and so forth. He was sort of an exemplar or avatar of the New Deal. In one of the first Superman comics, Superman investigates a mine disaster in which the coal miners were trapped underneath the ground and discovered there was no safety equipment. And the Superman's alter ego, Clark Kent, the mild-mannered reporter, interviews the mine owner, who says, "I'm not a humanitarian, I'm a businessman. I'm not going to waste money on safety equipment." And Superman has an idea. He somehow manipulates the mine owner to have a party in a mine shaft, and the mine collapses. And the mine owner discovers that there's no safety equipment. Superman then flies, Clark Kent goes to a phone booth, changes, you know, into his tights and flies in and saves the mine owner and his party guests, who has a epiphany. And he says, "You know, I used to be a callous capitalist, but now I realize the importance of life and that what my workers go through and henceforth." And he lists a series of changes to the mine: safety equipment, oxygen, you know, better hard hats, etc. And it's, of course, exactly what the mine workers union and New Deal social agencies were pushing for.
Had in mind Godzilla taking on the Smog Monster and other things. Similar?
Well, you know, again, in the 50s, the first Godzilla, you know, a product of nuclear testing in the Pacific. But later Godzillas become heroes, interestingly enough. The first one is wrecking Tokyo. But afterwards, Godzilla takes on social problems. Smog, pollution, even Western monsters like King Kong, whom he battles. So yeah, comics have often become a social media, but we often forget those origins.
Wonder Woman.
Wonder Woman, the original writer of Wonder Woman was a psychologist who was in a sort of an itinerant academic psychologist who invented the lie detector.
Oh, really?
And of course, Wonder Woman has that, lasso of truth, which she subdues villains with. She lassos them and they're forced to tell the truth. Obviously, it was a takeoff on the early lie detector.
This woman had invented.
Right. Well, it was a he, but he, interestingly enough, he lived in a complex social arrangement with Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood's niece. And many speculate that Wonder Woman, the prototype for Wonder Woman, was actually Margaret Sanger, the superwoman who excelled in many fields.
Wow, that's absolutely amazing. All right, a new op-ed piece you're working on, and folks, hopefully you will see it in the local paper, but we're going to give you a preview of it today. Has to do again with two things and how they tell us a story, and these two things are airplanes. One is the A-10 here in Tucson, where it's housed, and the other is the B-52 bomber. Michael?
Well, recently I went to the Pima Air and Space Museum. I had been there decades ago, and it was just starting, and it was really kind of a junkyard. It's now, you know, incredibly well-curated, elaborate, and fascinating place. And I was struck by how sleek, how macho not only the airplanes themselves, most of them were, but the names. You know, they had names that radiated power and speed. If I put my glasses on, I'll remember them. Skyhawk, Super Saver, Avenger, Tomcat, Phantom, Raptor, Thunder Chief. These names that evoked power and speed. And yet, two of the most prominent and long-lasting planes in the American arsenal, the A-10 and the B-52, have names that almost mock them. The Warthog, the A-10 fighter plane. The Buff, big, ugly, flying F, blank, 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 E-R, or Buff, as its acronym is. Yet these planes have lasted decades. In the case of the B-52, 70 years. In the case of the A-10 attack aircraft, over 50 years. And yet their mocking names have given them endearment to the public. Each has become almost like a cult airplane. They're in movies, they're in toy models. B-52 was the name of a rock group in the 1980s. But part of the reason is they were incredibly efficient war machines that can't be replicated in some ways. They were inexpensive to produce. Both in terms of constant dollars and their actual cost, and they do their jobs. In the case of the B-52, it was designed as a nuclear bomber. It's done everything, fortunately, besides that. And the A-10, a close ground support attack aircraft, for decades from their inception, the Pentagon and industry lobbyists campaigned to get rid of them and replace them.
The better mousetrap yet to be designed.
Right. But they couldn't. Almost everything they've done to try to replace them has not been as good. The very expensive F-35 to replace the A-10 is so fast that it can't really help troops on the ground. Its stealth coating constantly needs servicing. The A-10 is easily serviced, you know, can stay aloft, and has been very effective in every military engagement since the 1970s. The B-52... designed in the 1940s, first flown in 1952 and deployed in the 50s. Reagan used to quip in the 1980s, it was older than its pilots. It's actually, there's a recent pilot who found his grandfather flew a B-52. But they work. They're like a U-Haul. They deliver weapons they can be serviceable. If you look at the cockpit of a B-52, it looks like a Radio Shack from the 1960s, dials and cables and pulleys and so forth. But it works. Industry desperately wants to replace these things because there's, you know, a lucrative market. But every B-52 replacement has gone down the tubes. A nuclear-powered prototype was too radioactive and radiated the crew. Another model had great radar jamming. It was so great that it jammed itself. The most recent prototype replacement, the B-2 stealth bomber, that was $2 billion per plane, but it carries a fraction of the payload of a B-52, and it's difficult to fly in the rain because the stealth coating, which is unique characteristic, tends to wash off. And so the B-52 is now estimated to fly until 2050, almost 100 years after its first flight.
That's incredible. That's incredible. Bathrooms on the plane, I remember this. Tell us.
Originally, the B-52 had no bathrooms, and it stayed aloft for 8 or 10 hours. It could be refueled in mid-flight. So they often were 12-hour training missions. The crews were all male, and so they were given a policeman or motorman's friend, a rubber tube into a bucket, and that was the bathroom on the airplane. They've subsequently, I guess, put in porta potties.
You know, I wonder about planes today. I presume they go so fast, and you either shot down or you do your strike and come back, that no one thinks about putting a bathroom. I can't imagine a bathroom in a fighter jet. I mean,
right.
You're locked in. I wonder if those suits actually have a little, like for astronauts, little places to, you know.
We'll have to ask Martha McSally.
We'll have to ask Martha McSally. If you were guessing on future things that might make great historical op-eds, other things, anything that's just sort of crossing your mind, it hasn't crystallized yet, but you'd wonder about, you know, Al, this might work.
I think there are some, at least for me, and I think it speaks to what one's own background and specialties are in history. I was originally interested mostly in foreign policy and international relations, as well as sort of the rise of conservatism in the United States. So questions about immigration, about, you know, the cycles of the U.S. Loving and hating China, which goes back 200 years. We're in another cycle now, you know, of tension. So that's something. The history of immigration reform, you know, openness and closeness. Why? You know, what is it responding to the economy, to other concerns? Those are two that strike me.
I know we've had debates about the China issue, the balance between how much of that is just the old-fashioned William Randolph Hearst, the yellow fear of Asia, and how much of it reflects the truly advanced state of China's economy and its growing military, such that it's not just engaging in hysteria, but that it's a real peer competitor, as they say, on military and certainly on economic issues.
Sure, and I think that's important. There are real issues. I'm not trying to say that these are all, you know, psychological maladies of the American people at all. But what has interested me is how, when we do have real economic or strategic issues of tension or disagreement, racist tropes reemerge. So we talk about the yellow peril again. The issue might be intellectual property rights, but we describe them in terms of an insidious plan to take over the planet, you know, that's racially based. We often forget some of the most popular villains in American history were mock Chinese villains, Dr. Fu Manchu, in the pre-1960s period. So what interests me is, when we have real issues, material issues, why do some of us turn to old racial stereotypes?
It is fascinating, because there also are, let me take the other side, there also are Chinese white papers whereby 2030, 2050, they want China to be the leader in, you know, social media or 5G, right, or in space. And they want to, you know, not dominate the world, but lead the world. And right, and people do react. It's hard to pull the two of those out.
Don't our social media companies say they want to be number one in social media, or Boeing want to be number one in airplane production?
And even if they are growing, it's certainly the points you make are a healthy corrective to falling back into stereotypes. I remember briefly, we're down to about a minute, talking about immigration. You had some ideas about the role of the Bisbee strike and prisoners. Can you do a real quick version? We got about 50 seconds.
In 1917, almost 1,000 Bisbee miners who were members of a radical union were
Wobblies.
The industrial workers of the world were arrested, deported to the desert of Mexico, and it related to World War One. The U.S. had just ended World War One. These guys were considered German agents for wanting better wages. They were also immigrants, mostly, many of these miners. So everything sort of came together against them.
Again, so we've had a great hour talking with Mike Schaller, op-ed writer for The Times. I hope you enjoyed it, and he gave you some tips. 3 pages, double space. Send it off. You got nothing to lose, and you might get a letter back saying accepting it. Mike's thanks. Until next time, Al Bergeson for Smart Talk.